Okay, why don't we go ahead and get started? Good morning. Today, I would like to talk about a topic, unsupervised discriminative adaptation. I looked at the syllabus last night, and I think we sort of have a pretty good idea of how we're going to finish up the course. Today, I'd like to talk about this specific topic on supervised adaptation, discriminative adaptation. Next class, I'm going to talk about unsupervised adaptation using large amounts of data. And then that brings us to Tuesday of next week, which I will talk about sort of state-of-the-art systems and review some of the other techniques, just very briefly give you a touch on some of the popular techniques that are being used in various systems. And then on December 2nd, our remote students are going to actually do a demonstration, a lecture and a demonstration for us on sound localization using adaptive beamforming. They've actually been building a system, and they're going to come here and tell us about it and show us actually how it works. It's a pretty neat system, and I'm really looking forward to that. So that's sort of what we have planned for the next, for the final four classes of the semester. So today, what I'd like to do, we talked last time about discriminative training, and we talked about how powerful that can be, but it has the requirement that you need to know the truth marking for the data. In speech, what we call the transcription. In other applications, what you would call the true class assignments of the data. And that's, of course, a big problem for many applications, because in many applications, you don't really have the time or the resources to truth mark data. And oftentimes, in some applications involving personal communications, for example, like a cell phone, you don't want to actually have to truth mark the data for every possible user of the system, because you want the system to be able to adapt to specific users. So unsupervised adaptation is very important, because it allows systems to adapt to particular users. And when you have systems like cell phones or, you have millions and millions of users, so that's really important. And the maximum likelihood approach is very popular because of its ability to do unsupervised adaptation. And that's a concept that I'm going to hopefully reinforce today when I show you this nice piece of work that talks about unsupervised discriminative adaptation, and it builds on top of ML adaptation. So the work that we're going to talk about today comes from a paper by you, Gales, and Woodland, from a group at Cambridge that's very prominent in this area. They've done a lot of really good work on adaptation over the past 10, 15 years. So I've linked that paper from the course notes. This topic, discriminative training, is not something specific to speech, so I've linked a couple resources involving some work in image processing and such. So today what we'll do is we'll go through some motivation and perspective on the topic, then we're going to talk about this problem, this adaptation technique where we use these linear transformations, and then we'll specifically focus on technique used in this paper called discriminative mapping transforms. We'll talk about how you train these transforms, and then we'll spend some time talking about some experimental results on some speech recognition tasks to give you some idea of what these kinds of techniques are capable of. So today's lecture will focus on this paper. This was a paper published at the 2008 International Conference on Acoustic Speech and Signal Processing, fairly current work. And if you're interested in this kind of thing, this is one of the two major conferences where you see these kinds of things published. The most prominent conference is a conference called InterSpeech, and there's some related publications to this work at InterSpeech as well. Now, I want to sort of put a disclaimer here at the beginning that though this paper is focused on speech processing, the techniques described can be applied to any data set that demonstrates similar characteristics. Namely, what we're going to talk about today is a technique that leverages both what's called speaker-dependent data and speaker independent data. Now, this is not a concept specific to speech. What this really means is anytime you have a situation where you have a set of experimental conditions for which you have a large amount of data and you want to essentially train condition-independent models from that data, there's different ways that you can deal with this. So in the case of speech recognition, we have sort of a design choice when we try to collect data to train our models. The choice is whether we collect a large amount of data from a small number of speakers or whether we collect a small amount of data from a large number of speakers. Now, traditionally, if you want to build a system that works for all speakers without any training or any adaptation, you will collect a small amount of data from a large number of speakers. And by a large number of speakers, today we typically mean thousands of speakers. You may collect, you know, 30 minutes of data from 1,000 speakers. But if you want to then achieve high performance on a recognition task involving lots of data from a particular speaker, so suppose, for example, that your task is to recognize conversational speech by one or two speakers, for example, two speakers talking to one another over the phone for extended periods of time. If you simply use your speaker-independent system, you will get some nominal level of performance, and that performance won't really change throughout the course of that conversation. A conversation, let's say for the sake of argument, the conversation is 30 minutes long. Your system will not really change because you're not adapting it to that data. If, on the other hand, you want to try to adapt as that person's talking so that over the length of this 30-minute conversation, you can actually improve performance of the system, your strategy to collecting your training data may change a little bit. You may want to collect data in which you have larger amounts of data from individual speakers so that you can actually estimate both speaker-dependent and speaker-independent properties and then mix the two. And that's essentially what the technique we're going to talk about today tries to do. It tries to separate the speaker-independent and the speaker-dependent portions of the system so that as you go to recognize this 30-minute conversation, you can actually adapt to that conversation using standard techniques like maximum likelihood, but then you can also add to that discriminative transformations based on the speaker-independent properties of the data. Now, to do that, you're going to need data that reflects that kind of a condition. So there's a tendency to have data, a database where you have larger amounts of data from smaller numbers of speakers. And in this case, I think if I remember right, the training data is about 1,000 speakers, and I think it's 256 hours total data. That's on the last slide. Now, you know, some of you may say, uh-oh, here he is talking about speech recognition again. But if you think about this, this is a scenario which is really common to many, many different kinds of applications. When you go into an application space and you want to collect data, there's, as I mentioned, this kind of trade-off between the number of independent sessions you collect and the amount of data you collect from each one of those sessions. Now, in many applications, collecting independent trials is very expensive. For example, if you're let's say working on some kind of imaging problem and you're trying to recognize targets, and those targets happen to be things like missiles and airplanes and all these kinds of military things. Well, you just don't go out and get thousands and thousands and thousands of instances of this kind of data because the effort to collect any one of those pieces of data is very expensive. You may only be able to collect 150 on that order number of independent trials. But you can fortunately collect large amounts of data from each one of those trials. You can essentially record the whole session. Let's say you're doing test flights and things. Years ago, we faced this when we wanted to collect data for pilots who were under stress. And to simulate this, we actually had to put them in a centrifuge, which is a machine that spins them around and simulates G-forces. Well, you just don't put 3,000 people in a centrifuge, because first of all, there aren't even 3,000 people who are allowed to go in a centrifuge. We were lucky to get on the order of 10 to 20 speakers, but we could collect a whole session from these speakers, so we got a reasonable amount of data, pretty large amounts of data in those days from each one of these speakers. Now, when you have large amounts of data from small numbers of speakers, you become worried that if you're using a multiple mixture model, that those mixture modes, those mixture components, let's say you use 100 mixtures per state in some kind of hidden Markov model system, and you're collecting a database where you collect, let's say, 10 hours of data from a small number of speakers, 10 speakers. What you worry about is that those mixture components are going to learn the characteristics of individual speakers, because there's so few of them that the statistical models can actually focus on the identities of the speakers. So when you have these databases where you have large amounts of data from small number of speakers, you have to be a little bit careful when you train that if you want to train speaker-independent models or condition-independent models, you have to be worried that those models are not going to model artifacts of the speaker. So this is essentially a problem in, you could say, ensemble sampling, because in ensemble sampling, you try to collect multiple independent events, and then you compute averages across that ensemble of data. So the way to think about today's lecture is not so much that this is a speech lecture involving speaker-dependent, speaker-independent technology. This is really common to any problem where you have multiple sessions of data, and you have lots of data within those sessions, so that you can train essentially session-dependent transformations and then somehow average those across those sessions to get session-independent models. And I think that that's a problem that's very common to almost any signal processing application, whether you're talking about one-dimensional signals like audio or two-dimensional signals like images. And I don't find many papers at all where people are doing this kind of thing in images, for example, but it is equally applicable to image, and I think eventually you'll see some of this kind of thing filter its way into imaging and other types of processing. But because we have access to such large amounts of data in speech recognition, and because there's such commercial interest in speech recognition, we're able to do these things in speech recognition fairly easily. Another way to think about why this kind of topic today is so important. Think about, for example, I was just reading yesterday about Google announcing that they're going to provide voice search on the Google iPhone, on the Android. They're actually releasing it first on the iPhone. So the iPhone through Google will allow you to speak voice commands and actually do Google searches. So instead of going from your web browser, you can pick up your cell phone and say, show me all the restaurants near Starkville, and it will find them. Now, the interesting thing about this, when somebody like a Google or an iPhone releases this kind of an application, there will be millions and millions of users of this application almost instantly. So the ability to generate large amounts of training data, Google will have terabytes of data within a matter of days or hours. But what's the problem with that data with respect to adaptation? None of it's supervised, right? You'll just have the recordings of people's voices. The service, by the way, they're actually offering it uses a client-server approach, so it actually digitizes the voice on the phone, but it ships the voice off to a Google server to do the actual recognition and the search. So that's a typical example of how you can get access to terabytes of data instantly, but it's all unsupervised. You don't have the truth markings. There's a lot of interest in how we can leverage that kind of data resource. And the technique today that we'll talk about deals with this problem in the context of discrimination, where the lack of good supervision transcriptions is really critical. So the key contributions of this paper are with respect to the ability to estimate a discriminative transform that gives improved performance on unsupervised data. And we'll talk more about that in the next slide. That is a problem that's common to most pattern recognition applications, how you can do some kind of discrimination without access to the truth marking. And the core idea of the paper is to separate discrimination and ML-based adaptation. It actually does essentially a speaker-independent discrimination on top of an ML-based unsupervised adaptation. And that's sort of what's novel about this. And they show some interesting improvements in performance. Okay, so historical perspective. This paper has a nice summary of where we are with respect to adaptation on speech processing problems. Linear transforms, such as MLLR, we've talked about MLLR as a way to postulate a linear transformation of the mean, and then we've shown a way to train the parameters of that transformation matrix on adaptation data, are the most common form of adaptation for applications involving limited data. And in fact, what's often done in adaptation applications is to simply attach series of linear transformations. You may do a linear transformation to capture the speaker-independent portion of the adaptation. You may do a linear transformation then to capture the speaker-dependent portion of the data. Oftentimes, when you look at actual systems that do adaptation, they train sequences of these linear transformations. They sort of concatenate them. And that's not a problem because you can, in fact, concatenate these transformations very easily. The maximum likelihood must be used for unsupervised adaptation. It's the only technique we've described that works when you don't have the transcriptions and you can't do a supervised adaptation. Discriminative models, well, and in fact, with MLLR, we talked a little bit about how that's done in practice using outputs from the recognizer in an unsupervised mode, and I'll come back to that at the end of the paper when we talk about some of the experiments that they run. Discriminative models can be estimated on training data. That's where we went because we have typically have transcriptions for the training data, but are rarely appropriate for real applications. Now, people have tried to generate performance gains for discriminative models in unsupervised adaptation, but those gains have been limited. The most common approach to doing this is really very simple. You take the recognition system, you recognize the data using your current models, you use the output of that recognition system then as the supervision transcription, and then you can do discriminative training based on that supervision transcription. If the accuracy of the recognizer is high, this can work well because the transcription generated by the recognizer is suitably close to the true transcription, so you're effectively getting most of the benefits of the supervised training. However, discriminative training or adaptation is very sensitive to transcription errors. If the accuracy of the recognizer is low and the error rates on the transcriptions are high, you get very modest, if any, improvements in performance using discriminative adaptation, because it's essentially learning to discriminate the wrong things. If every other word in the output in the hypothesis is wrong, you have problems. Now, I should point out that even when you have supervised data, it's very common that there's some error rate associated with your supervised data. Now, I don't know how many of you have seen this in the research you're doing, but in speech recognition, this has been studied very closely over the years. In fact, we did some of the work on this many years ago at Mississippi State, that if you simply ask people to type what they hear, this is not as simple as it may seem, and if you ask humans to transcribe data, the error rates will range from as high as 10% to as low as about 1%, but there's always some amount of error. And the cost in reducing that error is very, as the error rates get lower, the cost becomes higher because, first of all, some of the data, people just can't agree what was actually spoken. Some of the data is difficult to recognize. In other cases, the person transcribing the data may not actually know some of the words that were spoken and may type the wrong words of the things. You can see this, for example, on if you watch closed captioning on television, even when it's done by humans, there's an error rate of about one or two words every 10 or 20 words. And it's always fun to watch the errors because the errors sometimes are spelling errors, sometimes the errors are semantic based. So there's always some error. Well, unfortunately, discriminative systems are very sensitive to this because they're trying to minimize error rate. So if you feed them bad transcriptions, that's what the discrimination will, training will learn, and that can be a bad thing. So the discriminative training is admittedly very sensitive to transcription errors. Well, unfortunately, if you think about an adaptation scenario, when do you want to actually get benefits from adaptation? You want benefits from adaptation when your initial recognition performance using the speaker-independent models is low, because you want to make the system better through adaptation. Well, that's a problem then, because if discriminative training can't work when the transcriptions are low, errors are high, you cannot use it to improve the system when performance is bad. So you sort of get into this catch-22 that when performance is bad, you can't improve the system. And therefore, discriminative adaptation using the output of the recognizer in this kind of a closed loop has not done very well, given very marginal improvements in performance. Now, one way that we mitigate the effects of transcription errors is that we use confidence measures or lattices. Confidence measures, this is another concept that was applied extensively in speech recognition, but is applicable to many other fields. This is simply a way of estimating when you produce an output, how confident you are in the output. And confidence measures can be something very simple, like simply the likelihood of the output that's generated during the recognition process, or they can be much more complicated, involving classifiers trained using neural networks and things that try to estimate independently from the likelihood process. They try to estimate independently what the confidence is in this output. Well, again, that's a very pleasing concept, because it you say, well, I'll just throw away the things that I'm not sure of using confidence measures. But again, in adaptation, the things we want to improve are the errors. And for the errors, we generally have low confidence. So if we throw away errors that are due to low confidence, we won't really get any mileage out of adaptation. So people try to use confidence measures to mitigate the error rates of the transcriptions, but again, they find that that limits the benefits of adaptation. Lattices is another way that people do this. Instead of using only the one best output, people actually use multiple outputs from the lattice, particularly with the MPE, the minimum phone error rate approach, where you have the access to the subsequence hypotheses. The lattice is just a way of saying, well, since I'm not sure what the one best hypothesis is, let me use some of the alternate hypotheses and try to adapt based on those as well, hoping that within one of those alternate hypotheses, there's actually the correct hypothesis. And again, doing this helps a little bit, but it also reduces the impact of adaptation, because the data you most need to adapt on is the data with the lowest confidence or the poorest recognition performance. Hence, discriminative adaptation has had limited success and has provided only marginal improvements in practice over ML. So, how can we get around this problem? We're going to have to preserve the unsupervised adaptation on the test data, but we'd like to somehow mix the use of discriminative transformations as well. So a number of methods to combine ML adaptation with discriminatively trained models have been explored, and you'll hear the term speaker adaptive transforms and feature-based adaptation. We'll hopefully touch on those a week from today when we talk about state-of-the-art. These approaches attempt to combine good speaker-independent discriminatively trained models with unsupervised speaker-dependent transformations. making use of the fact that what we talked about earlier, when you have a lot of data from a single speaker, you can essentially adapt to that speaker. But what we're going to do in this work is something a little different. We're going to define a criterion mapping function as an attempt to map a speaker-independent transform from one condition to another via some form of mapping. So we're going to postulate a mapping. We're going to essentially, in the process of doing discriminative training, try to train a speaker-independent transformation on the training data. And then we're going to try to use that speaker-independent transformation on the evaluation data in conjunction with the ML unsupervised adaptation. And this criterion mapping function can be linear or nonlinear. In this work, we're going to focus on linear transformations. So in this work, the goal is to map a speaker-specific ML-estimated linear transform. And hopefully, the particular technique that was chosen here was to use the MPE discriminative training approach, though there's no reason you couldn't use MMI or any of the other techniques that we discussed. And you may recall that MPE is one of the three discriminative training techniques in which the phone or subsequence errors are minimized. We talked about that in our introduction to discriminative training. So a linear transform will be estimated and used for this mapping, this criterion mapping function. And this transform is referred to as a discriminative mapping transform. In theory, this approach can be applied to any form of linear transform. We can do either the mean covariance or the features directly or both. The focus of this work will be just on mean adaptation, which is where you get the most mileage with this kind of approach. People have postulated these linear transforms and trained them discriminatively, and that's what's called discriminative linear transformations. And the discriminative mapping transformation you can think of as a variant of the DLT approach. So now we're going to try to motivate this DMT approach. So MLLR was an approach to estimate a linear transform of the mean. And in MLLR, we take the Gaussian means, which here are mu. So for each mixture component, we have a mean and a covariance. We focus on the means. And we postulate a transformation of that mean that consists of a transformation matrix and an offset. And we actually folded these together into a matrix times this augmented vector psi, which was just 1 plus the mean values, so that we could simply worry about the estimation of this transformation matrix. We also derived a technique for estimating this transformation matrix using maximum likelihood. And we showed, and that was what we essentially called maximum likelihood linear regression, because we showed that this is essentially a form of regression. And we showed how the estimates of that, the process for estimating this matrix does actually involve optimization of the overall likelihood of the data given the model. And we derived techniques for doing that based on the EM theorem and based on using the state occupancies and such, and folded this very nicely into a hidden Markov model context, where we can use the byproducts of the hidden Markov model optimization, such as the accumulated state occupancies, to compute a weighted update of this matrix based on the prior estimates of the mean and the occupancies computed on the adaptation data. So we ended up with sort of our standard formulation, where the new vector is equal to the old vector plus some proportion of the estimates of the new data. We also talked about the fact that we can do one transformation per Gaussian, but in a system with many, many Gaussians, for example, in a speech recognition system, we might have tens of thousands of these Gaussians. We would somehow want to limit the number of these transformation matrices because we want to limit the number of parameters we're introducing into the adaptation system because we have limited amounts of adaptation data. So we talked about the fact that, well, we could use one transformation across all of the data, just a global transformation, or we could actually somehow try to cluster these thousands of Gaussians so that maybe we use 100 or so of these transformations and we figure out which Gaussians are close, are clustered together, so that for each cluster we can use essentially one of these transformations. And that's a very key part of getting any of these techniques to produce an improvement in performance for a problem like speech recognition. And in speech recognition, the number of independent transforms we may use may be as low as 10 to 20, or it may be as high as 1,000. In this discriminative work, we're actually going to use 1,000 transforms. But it's not on the order of 10,000 or hundreds of thousands, because that would be too many free variables. At that point, it would be better just to do ML adaptation of the model itself. We also talked about the fact that there were different ways that you can cluster these things. You can cluster them based on some prior knowledge, such as the which Gaussians correspond to which phonemes of the language, or you could cluster them based on unsupervised clustering. You could look at, just throw these into some kind of standard K-means clustering or something like that, and decide which Gaussians are close based on some kind of similarity measure. Or you could do something a little more sophisticated. You could throw them into a decision tree and use likelihood information from the EM process to create this decision tree so that you're creating, you're clustering Gaussians that appear to be close on the basis of posterior probabilities and such. And in this paper, they'll actually explore several of these approaches for clustering the transforms. And I think the first table we have on experimental results at the end will discuss this. So that was the MLLR portion. Then we discussed ways to estimate the transform discriminatively. And the form of that transformation looks the same. We have a matrix times the mean vector plus some offset, which we can again model as just a linear transform times an augmented mean vector. And we explored set up an approach. We actually explored the MMI approach to estimating this transformation matrix W. And if you recall, the key thing that we did there was essentially re-estimate this transformation matrix using a mixture of ML information and the discriminative information. So we ended up with an adaptation equation that still updated, it produced the new means were essentially the old means plus some modifications based on the adaptation data, but the form of those modifications looked at the ratio of the ML estimates to the discriminative estimates. We talked about the numerator and denominator terms. The ML estimates were trying to maximize the likelihood of the model given the data, and the discriminative estimates in the denominator were trying to minimize the confusions with the incorrect answers. So we ended up with a discriminative update equation that was based on both the ML solution and the discriminative solution. And the discriminative solution was computed by looking at state occupancies across the lattice, which contained information about all the incorrect choices as well as the correct choice. So I hope that at a high level that that concept is somewhat clear. Now, we also alluded to the fact that there were other ways to do this kind of discriminative training. And in the work discussed in this paper, they actually build on top of the minimum phone error approach, which amounts to minimizing a loss function that compares the actual string produced by your current set of models. You could call that the one best hypothesis, and the true or the known string representing that data. And we didn't really discuss the details of this, but essentially a gradient descent type approach is used to minimize that loss function. And in the process of deriving that, you essentially still end up with a similar kind of update where you have the new values are equal to the old values plus some modification based on the gradient of this function. Now, we won't go into the details of that today, but we'll just note that the form of the maximization is a little different. It involves this likelihood, that loss function, which compares the current one best answer from your models to the truth answer. And this truth answer is what we don't really have. So that's going to be a problem if we want to apply this to the unsupervised recognition problem where we don't have the answer. So to estimate the loss function, we need to know the transcription, this H superscript of S. This approach has worked well for supervised adaptation, but has not worked as well for unsupervised adaptation. And we've seen that the MMI trained models can be combined with the ML trained adaptation to produce reasonable gains in performance. If you remember at the end of the MMI lecture, we talked about all these different combinations of the systems you could build. You could use ML trained models, use MMI adapted models, you could use MMI trained models and MMI adaptation, and we looked at all the different cross connections. And the work in this paper essentially builds on that concept. This MMI approach can be applied to features, models, or most other forms of transformations. We haven't really talked about that. I hope to touch on that in the next two classes. We can actually, instead of modifying the means of the Gaussian mixtures, we can postulate a transformation of the feature vectors themselves. And we can then derive a discriminatively trained transformation that attempts to transform the features themselves from one condition to another condition. And that's essentially where you could say that that's the simplest form of adaptation. If you train your models in an environment, for example, the acoustics of this room, and then you use your recognizer in a different scenario, like a cell phone, you might argue that a way to account for that change in environment is to simply postulate a linear transform of the features themselves, hoping that that linear transform will model the differences between the acoustics of this room and the acoustics of a cell phone. Now, this was tried years ago with microphones. If early on we thought that even for something simple, like different microphones, that this would be an effective process. But even for just trying to account for the differences in microphones, for example, you might be using a handheld close talking microphone in one case, and you might be using this desk mounted open air microphone in another case, and you'd like to account for the differences between the two with a linear transformation. Well, it's well known that microphones are very nonlinear devices, and in fact, the linear transformation does some good, but it doesn't completely account for the differences just in microphones, let alone the differences in acoustics and such. So it's at best a weak approximation, but MMI adaptation of features has been one popular thing that's been introduced in the last few years, and it gives you some very small but measurable improvement performance. But today we're going to focus on adaptation of the means, though everything we talk about can be applied to adaptation of other aspects of the model. So the this is sort of the money slide. This is the defines the discriminative mapping transform. We mentioned that the criterion mapping function introduces a speaker-independent transformation of the speaker-specific transforms. So we're going to start with our speaker-specific transform. So you take your training data and you first train your one way to think about this is you can train your speaker-independent models across all of the training data. Then you can take a single speaker and you can train you can essentially adapt your speaker-independent models to that single speaker using maximum likelihood adaptation, MLLR, for example. And what we'd like to do then on top of that is then take those models and estimate a discriminative transformation that's a function of all of these speaker-dependent transformation models. So we'd like to look at all of these, if you think about this, I think the best way to, this is sort of the core concept of the paper, and I think it's important to understand the essence of this. If you think about the process of, let's say you record in this room acoustics and you want to recognize data on a cell phone. And let's say you collect lots of data from this room for these speakers, and you build your speaker independent models on this room. And then you adapt each one of those models to individual speakers. So you take what were models designed to work across all speakers and you focus them on individual speakers. And let's say you have 100 speakers in your database. So you end up with these 100 different transformations of the data for each one of these speakers. Now, what do you think will happen if you essentially try to average across these individual transformations for the speakers? So the first question to ask is, well, what do we accomplish by training this speaker-specific transformation? Well, the speaker-specific transformation, we would hope, would focus on specific aspects of that speaker. Maybe that speaker is a male, a female speaker, child, or maybe that speaker has some particular quality to their voice that's somewhat unique. But if you average across all of these transformations, you're averaging across all of these independent speaker characteristics. What do you expect to get with that average? Well, what you should get with that average is some kind of generalization of the acoustics of this room. So you can sort of think about this as this discriminative speaker-independent transformation tries to sort of grab the essence of whatever discriminative transforms are learning. It's trying to model that, but it's trying to separate out from that the discriminative aspects for each one of the speakers. Now contrast that with the process of using discriminative training in a supervised mode on one particular speaker. In that case, what's going to happen is the system is going to learn how to discriminate for that particular speaker. Now, that may be, the answer to that question might be something very specific to that speaker. Maybe that speaker poorly articulates certain words, and those don't provide you discrimination, and other words, they're very clearly articulated, and those provide you good discrimination. And if you train that transform on that particular speaker, it will learn that information. But that information will not be generalizable to another speaker because that other speaker may have a completely different pathology, if you will. So what this is trying to do, it's trying to say, well, I would like to learn the general properties of discrimination for, let's say, a language. For example, in English, we know that consonants are more discriminable than vowels. It's hard sometimes to differentiate vowels in English. Consonants are much more easily discriminated. And maybe this transform can learn that kind of general information, but it by averaging across all these speakers, it's not going to learn the speaker in specific information. So what this approach is trying to do, it's trying to essentially separate out a speaker-independent discrimination transformation from a speaker-dependent ML adaptation transformation. So we're going to postulate a mapping from the speaker-dependent transformations or speaker-specific transformations to a speaker-independent discriminative transformation. And this mapping, then we can learn this on the training data with the hope that when we learn this on the training data, it will generalize to the test data without any additional adaptation, because this, what we're learning, should be independent of the particular conditions and it should be a general property of the data. So we'll let the speaker-specific transformations capture the shifts in the acoustic environments and things, and we'll let the discriminative transformation capture the general discriminative properties of the application or the language once you've normalized out all these other things. So this CMF attempts to map the ML-trained transforms into discriminative transforms, and it's essentially going to be a transform on top of another transform. The mapping function is trained in a speaker independent manner so that it can be applied to any speaker. And the form of this transform that's been investigated in this paper is actually a vectorization of the transform. So instead of what we're going to do is essentially assume that the, if you recall, when we did MLLR, we tried to constrain the transformation matrix so that there weren't so many degrees of freedom in the transformation matrix. And what we're going to do here is to essentially do the same kind of thing, constrain the transformation matrix to be a banded matrix, and then we'll estimate a discriminative transform based on that. And this is just a way of essentially reducing the number of degrees of freedom that have to be learned. So this discriminative transformation matrix in this particular work is restricted to a block diagonal matrix. And I don't want to dwell on that. The authors have a long history of doing this kind of thing. This is simply a way of, instead of letting this HDL be completely unconstrained, which would be difficult to estimate, they've actually constrained it to be block diagonal, which simply means either only the diagonal is non-zero, or it can sometimes be banded diagonal. You can have maybe the first row off the diagonals. The first, if you think about it, a diagonal, you can take the first set of elements one row off the diagonals in either direction. That's what's called a banded diagonal matrix. But I think for the purposes of this class, we don't need to worry about this so much. We can just note that there's going to be some additional transformation matrix that we're going to try to learn in going from the ML adapted models to the discriminatively trained models. Now, the beauty of the benefit of this is that for mean adaptation, this reduces to a very familiar looking form where we're essentially going to adapt the ML adapted means by this discriminative transform. And the nice thing about this is that the process for estimating this discriminative transform is essentially the same as our process for estimating any discriminatively trained linear transform. It's essentially our discriminative adaptation equations, but they're going to be applied on the training data. And they're going to be applied on the training data using the supervision transcriptions. So so essentially, all that's really done here is a two-step process where you take the training data, and you do the speaker independent model estimation to build a baseline system. Then you do the speaker, the ML-based speaker adaptation to do the to get the these speaker-specific transforms, and then and then you take those speaker-specific transforms, and then from that you estimate this discriminatively trained transform using the exact same approach that we've previously described for discriminative training. I think we have one more slide that describes that. So the training criterion for the DLT can be expressed as the process of finding the W, which maximizes this posterior, which represents the hypothesis given the ML model, which we just described how to get that, the ML adapted model. W is your degree of freedom. You're going to vary W to maximize this in such a way that you still minimize the penalty function or the loss function on the training data. So the estimation of the discriminative transform still requires knowledge of the supervision transcription, but this is done on the training data where you have access to that information. So this is computed on the training data, and it's computed using the ML-derived transforms for each speaker. And then you'll also notice that it's summed over all the speakers. So we're essentially averaging this transform across all the speakers, and we're doing that in a posterior sense rather than just a uniform average sense. And the advantage of this is that we have much more supervised data to use to estimate the discriminative transform. But there's every reason to believe that this transform is going to be independent of the particular training database, so it should map to the unknown adaptation data. This is computed on the training data. So in training, this transform, this approach essentially adjusts W to minimize the loss function using the ML parameter estimates derived from the training data. In recognition mode, this transform is used in conjunction with the ML adapted estimates from the unsupervised adaptation data. So in recognition mode, you're going to do the conventional MLOR adaptation, which is unsupervised ML-based adaptation, and then you're simply going to apply this transform with no additional retraining. So we're attempting to decouple the adaptation aspects of the system from the discrimination aspects of the system, hoping that the discriminative aspects are independent of the change in environment or the change in conditions between the training data and the test data. Instead, so that's essentially the gist of the method. You could think of it as a two-step adaptation method. First we do the ML adaptation, then we do the discriminative adaptation. Now, instead of training a single, instead of training a single transformation, multiple transformation matrices can be estimated using a process similar to the regression classes in MLR. For example, the mean vectors can be clustered, and a transformation matrix can be built for each cluster. Alternately, this can be clustered by decision trees, phonetic characteristics, or both, and we'll show an experimental results demonstrating this. And this is always something that's, I think this is a really important thing to understand about adaptation. I don't care what adaptation method you use, you will always get your best results with adaptation by figuring out, essentially, you can think of this as you have a knob that you can turn on the number of parameters you're trying to train using adaptation. And you turn that knob to maximize performance. So that you're always trying to figure out from your adaptation data how many new parameters you can reliably estimate. If you start with simply one global transformation matrix, even though the theory may be sound, you'll always do worse than if you actually try to allocate more than one transformation and you try to experimentally decide how many of these transformations you can tolerate with the given amount of training data that you have. So I mention this because as graduate students, you're going to want to try to keep things simple. You're going to, for example, postulate a single transformation. And you'll run your experiments and you may be disappointed with your results, because the only way you'll get state-of-the-art results is if you actually optimize the number of transformation matrices as part of the experiment. And that's I think, a hard reality for graduate students to deal with, because that means you have to have access to some kind of state-of-the-art system, if you will, that you can use to optimize the parameters. But if you don't do this, and you try to compare your results to the published literature, you're always going to do worse. Because no matter what adaptation technique you're using, the state-of-the-art systems invariably try to increase the number of parameters up to that point where they maximize performance, given the amount of training data that they have. The training data may support more than one transformation matrix, and the only way you'll find out how many is by running a set of experiments to determine the optimal number of transformation matrices. That's not discussed extensively in this actual paper, but I can guarantee you that they went through those kinds of experiments to understand the method. Okay, so that's the method. And now let's talk about a few experiments that were run to try to assess the performance of this system. Now, the last page of this paper actually describes the experiments in a fair amount of detail, but unfortunately you have to understand a bit about speech recognition systems for that to make sense. So I'm going to skim over that and try to just hit the high points of this. But if you want to talk offline about more of the details, we can. But I think the most important thing about the experimental setup is the data, the general characteristics of the data. So in this scenario, they used 5,000 speakers and 256 hours of training data. So the total amount of training data was 256 hours. That was divided between across 5,000 speakers. So you're talking about something like 30 minutes of data per speaker, I think, is something like that. That's kind of a standard number. And the data actually is primarily telephone data that was collected across cell phones and standard wired telephone lines, as I recall. The adaptation data consisted of 144 new speakers, very important, new speakers. The speakers in the adaptation data are what's called disjoint from the training data. That's the only way this can really be a fair evaluation. And you were given a total of 6 hours of adaptation data, so a much smaller amount of adaptation data per speaker. The adaptation data, I think was also taken from telephone. I'm not exactly sure where they in the paper, they cite the reference for the adaptation data, but I don't recall the details of that set, but it's essentially a blind evaluation set. So you do not have access in theory to the reference transcriptions, though they actually have a nice experiment here where they do actually use the reference transcriptions. So the first thing that was done was to investigate the number of discriminative transformations to be trained. And that was done relative to essentially a standard baseline. And the clustering that was investigated, they looked at three different values of the acoustic clustering. So in this case, this is a case where you're simply clustering all the Gaussians based on some similarity measure, and then you're allocating, I think everyone here should be familiar with basic clustering algorithms like k-means or something. These are very standard algorithms where you can control the number of clusters that you get. And they looked at clusters of two. Two is important because that would be, you might say, well, it's going to learn essentially male and female speakers. 46 is important because that's roughly the number of phonemes in the language that's used. And 1,000 is important because that's much higher and gives you better performance. But it's about, it's probably, in this kind of a system, they're using about 8,000 to 10,000 states, I believe, and each one of those states probably has 64 mixtures. So you're talking about 640,000 Gaussians. So this is still a substantial reduction in the number of Gaussians, at least like two and a half orders of magnitude. And then also they looked at a way of doing some kind of knowledge-based clustering based on the phonetic classes associated with the Gaussian. So you take every Gaussian that corresponds to a particular phonetic class and you cluster those together. You sort of do this with a priori information, whereas here it's done in a data-driven way. So the baseline error rate of the system is 27%. I believe on this task, if you actually ran a full-blown state-of-the-art system, I think your error rate would be on the order of about 20%. So this is a pretty good system, but it's not state-of-the-art, but it's a good sort of baseline system. So you can see that for the first thing here, when they looked at performance as a function of the number of clusters, and they also looked at it as a function of the number of training iterations. Now, I'll discuss the training iterations in a second, so don't worry too much about that for the moment. But you can see that performance generally improves when you go from two clusters, performance is about the same. At 46 clusters, performance improves very, very slightly, not statistically significant. At 1,000 clusters, performance improves very small amount, still not statistically significant, but you might say consistent. And as they iterate, they get some additional improvement. And then I'll discuss the iteration in a minute. But what's interesting about this is, by iterating, they actually get a greater improvement than the baseline method. And then when they use the knowledge-based clustering, they get slightly worse performance. Again, there's a lot of, these numbers are probably not statistically significant, but the point here is that with the 1,000 data-driven clusters, they can essentially get as good performance as using knowledge-based clustering. So there's no reason not to use data-driven transforms. Now, I would argue that, on the other hand, there's a significant difference in the number of parameters associated with these two methods. So this 1,000 cluster system may not actually be the best one to use in practice because it's got a lot more parameters associated with it. But fortunately, in any event. So the next thing that they looked at was how the system varies as a source of the supervision transcription. Now, let me explain what that means. So we talked about the fact that with MLLR, you need to know the answer because you have to adapt the parameters based on knowing what states are associated with what frames and such, and that is done with the MLLR approach. That's done by generating the one best hypothesis during recognition, and then using that hypothesis as, quote, the true answer or the reference. An alternate approach is rather than rely only on the one best output from the recognizer, to actually do the adaptation across the entire lattice. Now, this is what's done. This is what's done with in MMI. We noted how we had to use the lattice to generate the correct class and the incorrect class. With the MPE approach, you can actually do the minimization of the loss function across all hypotheses rather than just the one best. So you can think about this as a way of essentially saying, well, rather than rely only on the one best, I'm going to also consider all plausible alternate explanations of the data and sequentially work through those and update my discriminative training, assuming those are all different answers for the same string. And then the important point, the third point is very important, because that's actually the supervised mode. That's asking the question. That's sort of a cheating experiment. It's asking a question. Assume that I know everything. I know the answer on the data. This is the best that I could do with MLR. This would be fully supervised MLR. Now, you'll notice with these experiments, one of the things that you'll notice here is the big difference between guessing the transcription based on the output of the recognizer and actually using the truth marking. There's still a significant difference there. Closing that margin is essentially what this research is all about. So this tells you the total available improvement in performance, in essence. And what you can see is that the technique we're talking about is still very, very close to the one end of the spectrum, which is not good, actually. It's close to what you get with the one best MLR approach. It's still a long ways away from what's the total benefit that you could achieve. So you could say that this is sort of a failure, though nothing's ever a failure when you get performance improvements. But, you know, this is important because to me this says, well, what you've gained here is very small relative to the total amount that you could have gained. Okay, so that sort of sets up the baseline condition. So when we now go from MLLR to the discriminative mapping transform using the one best hypothesis, we get a 0.8% improvement in performance. When we go to the lattice, we get about the same because the MLR baseline drops a little. And when we go to the reference, we get about the same. So what's interesting here is that by going to the discriminative mapping transform, we pick up about the same amount of improvement across the three conditions. Now that's a good thing. That says that it seems like this thing is doing something that's consistent across these three approaches. So maybe in fact it is learning something that's somewhat independent of the data. But if you also then look at this last line, the DLT, this is classic discriminative training as we described last class. And this requires knowledge of the supervision, knowledge of the true transcription. And here, this DLT was trained for a one best hypothesis, a lattice, and a reference. Now, what that means is that this is the method, this 21.7, the reference, this is essentially what we described in class. This is knowing the answer and then training a discriminative model to learn how to produce that answer. This is essentially what happens when you use a noisy estimate of the true answer based on the output of the recognizer. So you'll also see that there's a big difference between these two numbers, about 5% difference in error rate. This is again what research, a gap that research is trying to close. Because this says, this is a cheating experiment. This is what I could get if I knew the answers for the adaptation data. But we've talked about the fact that I won't really ever know that. This is what we get if I try to guess those answers using the current recognizer. This is a big gap. This is, in fact, a bigger gap than this. Than the MLR approach. So this shows you there's some significant benefit to be gained by discriminative training, but the supervision problem is a real problem. And this also shows you that the DMT approach is still very close to what I get with the DLT, and it's not really getting as close to what I potentially could get. So again, you might say, well, this is an example of failure, because what I've recovered, I started off this lecture by telling you we're going to introduce this unsupervised discriminative training approach, but by making this unsupervised, we're recovering only a very small amount of what can be recovered from the true discriminative approach where we know the answer. So that means that's good news in the sense that it means there's more research to be done, more conference papers to be generated. But that's bad news in the sense that it says this DMT approach is not doing a whole lot. And so that brings me sort of to the last thing I wanted to comment on today, which is I like talking about these kinds of things because it shows you what research is all about. It shows you the hard work you have to do to get very, very small improvements in performance. And it shows you how you can publish really good conference papers, but not perhaps really make money in the end or solve problems for your customer. And there's hundreds and hundreds of these kinds of adaptation papers. All very nice mathematics, all, you know, on a very solid theoretical basis. But this is sort of the reality that we're still a far ways away from what we can achieve if we know if we're able to adapt based on the truth. And that's really what adaptation is all about, trying to adapt the models in an unsupervised way but achieve the same results we would get if we were doing fully supervised adaptation. So in summary, we discussed this hybrid approach to adaptation that attempts to separate discrimination from ML. We described a new framework for robust discriminative unsupervised adaptation that uses a speaker independent criterion mapping function coupled with ML estimated speaker dependent transforms. The transformation, the good news is this approach is not highly sensitive to the source of the adaptation hypothesis. Whether we use one best, lattice, or reference, we get about the same amount of improvement with the DMT. On the other hand, the bad news is that amount of improvement is very small. A simple initial implementation based on linear transforms was described, and the authors are working on, they have sort of a history of, they will now try to generalize this using alternate transforms and such. But I'm not sure that that's going to be all that promising. So it'll be interesting to see what they publish on this next year. But what I want to talk about next, class, is a very interesting paper that's generating a fair amount of excitement showing the impact of adapting on unsupervised adaptation using very, very large amounts of data. And this is specifically targeted at applications like the Google application that we were discussing, where you can have access to millions and millions of hours of data, but it's all unsupervised. And the question is, what can you do with that data if I give that to you? Can you do better than simply using supervised training as is traditionally done? And we'll talk about not a solution. The paper is not a solution as much as the paper calibrates the challenge. And I think that challenge is important because you'll face this in many, many problems, whether we're talking about remote sensing or bioinformatics or these kinds of things. You always have access to large amounts of unstructured data. And really what's very the hot button of research in the adaptation field is how to adapt on unstructured data versus how to adapt better on structured data. Okay, well I hope that was okay. I think that went pretty well. All right, see you on Thursday.